This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Blind Man's Bluff, the untold story of American submarine espionage, by Sherry Sontag and Christopher Drew, with Annette Lawrence Drew. Narrated by George K. Wilson, including an interview with the authors.
Prologue. There was something about Commander Charles R. McVean that had a way of inspiring legend. It wasn't the way he looked, tall, a little chunky, and in his late 30s, already crowned by a thatch of thinning gray hair. It was his sense of humor and his humanity. This was a man who could stand beneath a hatch after being doused with a column of water, deadpan, and still chewing his dripping pipe. This was also the man who had just led the nuclear attack submarine USS Seawolf on one of the most dangerous operations of the Cold War. She had slipped inside a Soviet sea and eavesdropped on the enemy in a way most other subs could never dare. Now, finally home, McVean was enjoying the chance to get some sleep. The phone rang. McVean snapped awake and checked the time. 2 a.m. The call was from Navy headquarters in Washington, D.C., and the voice on the other end of the line belonged to a somewhat embarrassed and very confused Navy officer. "There's a sailor from your ship at a bar called the Horse and Cow," he said. "And he's trying to call the president to tell him what a great job you did and how great you are. Could you go get him out of the phone booth?" McVean knew just where the Horse and Cow was, as did all of his men. This was the submariner's haunt in Vallejo, California, a darkened place decorated with pieces of just about every sub that ever steamed through the Pacific toward the Soviet Union, a place where men built themselves up for what they would face out at sea, and where they celebrated survival when they made it home. The commander rousted his chief of the boat, and together they drove over to the spot isolated along a highway service road and pulled into a parking lot that was more potholes than pavement. Sure enough, they found a somewhat inebriated member of Seawolf's crew, lodged in a phone booth, still trying to talk his way past a White House operator. McVean got his man off the phone, then bought him a beer. McVean was that kind of captain. Besides, he knew the guy deserved one. They all did. This happened in the mid-1970s, but it could have occurred at almost any time during the Cold War. McVean and his men were, after all, part of an intelligence operation unlike any other in the annals of American history. For more than four decades, under the cover of classifications even higher than top secret, the United States sent tens of thousands of men in cramped steel cylinders on spy missions off the rugged coasts of the Soviet Union. There, the job was to stay hidden, to gather information about the enemy's intentions and its abilities to wage war at sea. By their very nature, submarines were perfect for this task, designed to lurk nearly silent and unseen beneath the waves. They quickly became one of America's most crucial spy vehicles. No other intelligence operation has embraced so many generations of a single military force. No other has consistently placed so many Americans at risk. As many as 140 men on each sub, several subs at a time. Nearly every man who ever served on a U.S. attack submarine was sent to watch Soviet harbors and shipyards, monitor Soviet missile tests, or shadow Soviet subs. Several boats, such as Seawolf, were specially equipped to tap cables or retrieve pieces of Soviet weapons that had been fired in tests and had fallen to the bottom of the sea. No one was involved who didn't volunteer. These submarine spies stood as lonely sentries on the front lines of a war that was waged fiercely by both sides. Only in this war, The most important weapons weren't torpedoes, but cameras, advanced sonar, and an array of complicated eavesdropping equipment. And while these men rode some of the most technologically daunting craft ever built, their goals were deceptively simple. Know thy enemy. Learn enough to forestall a surprise attack, to prevent, at almost any cost, a repeat of Pearl Harbor in a nuclear age. In silence and stealth, but most importantly in secrecy, attack subs carried out as many as 2,000 spy missions as they kept track of Soviet submarines. Most crucial was tracking the boomers, Soviet subs longer than football fields that carried up to 20 ballistic missiles. These missiles could launch up to 10 nuclear warheads each, and a single missile sub could create a firestorm greater than the combined power of all the bombs dropped in World War II. That these arsenals were portable and hidden at sea made them much less vulnerable and much more dangerous than bombs designed to be sent on planes or launched from fixed spots on land. There was only one good way to counter missiles carried on submarines, and that was with other subs. It was of little wonder, then, that learning about these missile subs and trailing them became the single biggest priority of the U.S. Navy. This was worth almost any risk. This was the reason submariners were sent out again and again. This is what motivated the decades-long game of blind man's bluff. It was in this quest to track Soviet advances and Soviet subs that men traded their homes, the sun, and any illusion of privacy for the crowded windowless craft and felt their way through the exotic ocean terrains that cover two-thirds of the globe. They traversed down to the Mediterranean, up to the icy hazards of the Arctic, and often straight into Soviet territorial waters. They lived with barely a view of the oceans and seas they traveled through, save for what they could glimpse through the glass of a periscope, or imagine from electronic flickers playing upon sonar screens, and oceans of static scratching through sonar men's headsets. In the cold and dark, submariners faced hazards worse than those that have traditionally confronted seafaring men, for the ocean pressures could easily crush steel hulls should they go too deep. Over the years, such catastrophes struck submarines from both sides. Just as threatening were the Soviets themselves, who were determined to stop these American spies, and fought back as best they could, sometimes with depth charges, sometimes by enlisting American military and intelligence staffers to spy for them. The risk in all of this became increasingly obvious as Soviet and U.S. subs engaged in frantic chases, as misjudgments led to collisions, as U.S. submarines were detected in Soviet waters. To the Soviets, American submariners were more than an enemy. They were ever-present pests. To other Americans, they were simply the anonymous men of the silent service. This book is their story, one that has gone unspoken and unheralded until now. This is one of the last great untold stories of the Cold War. At its heart, the motivation for the submariner's hunt, to prevent an adversary from launching a wave of death from the oceans, seems almost timeless. In the early 16th century, Leonardo da Vinci sketched out a design for a proto-submarine, but wrote in his notebook that he'd never reveal how one would run underwater, because he feared the evil nature of men, who would use them as a means of destruction at the bottom of the sea. Still, it was that very potential for surprise devastation that spurred on inventors who followed. During the Civil War, they tried to build bubble-shaped subs and then others that looked like short cigars, all to stick mines on the bottoms of enemy ships. The subs were powered by hand cranks and treadmills, and most of the men killed by these new weapons were members of their own tiny crews. Still, there was terror in the sheer attempt, and it was only a few years after the Civil War that Jules Verne, in his novel 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, depicted the submarine as a sea monster ramming ships. That his creation was powered with electricity was prophetic. The Holland, the U.S. Navy's first working submarine, ran on electric batteries when submerged, a gas engine on the surface. Purchased on April 11, 1900, she was only 50 feet long and held a crew of six. Submarine technology progressed so rapidly that less than a generation later, Germany's diesel-powered submarines were terrorizing Allied ships during World War I. It was one of these German U-boats that shattered U.S. neutrality by sinking the British passenger liner Lusitania after she sailed from New York in 1915. By the time the United States entered the war 2 years later, German U-boats had destroyed several hundred ships. By World War II, submarines had become so powerful they were able to go after armed surface convoys, and they had become a decisive factor. Germany sent its subs out in wolf packs that could converge for a kill, a tactic so lethal that the United States seized on it to regain control of the Pacific after Pearl Harbor. The impact on Japanese troop ships, tankers, and freighters was devastating, but it came with great cost. The United States lost 52 subs and 3,500 men. It is these World War II images of subs shooting torpedoes, of men trapped, sweating within cramped steel cylinders as Japanese sonar pings rang through their hulls and depth charges fell around them, that remain most vivid. But there was something else going on in those days as well, the beginning of a tentative courtship between submariners and spies. A few times, subs put up simple antennas to intercept Japanese radio messages, and about a dozen submarines were sent to conduct periscope beach reconnaissance to prepare for troop landings. These experiments piqued the interest of intelligence officials and showed that submarines could have a new mission once the Cold War began. Diesel subs were the first to give it a try. Then came the creation of submarines with nearly endless power and unlimited stealth, boats powered by nuclear reactors that could remain submerged for months at a time. With these, U.S. submariners would grasp the definitive edge in the Cold War under the seas. The details of all this have been closely held by top admirals and captains within the Navy, who typically disclose these operations only to the President, his top military and intelligence advisors, and a few congressmen who only rarely pressed for details. But ultimately, control of any mission rested in the hands of young submarine captains, who were usually about 35 years old, and under orders to maintain complete radio silence. These men were encouraged to take risks, and some slipped right into Soviet harbors or into the middle of Soviet naval exercises to bring home the best information. Still, their prime directive remained: avoid detection and keep the Soviets unaware of just how closely they were being watched. That necessity, more than anything, was also what impelled the staunch secrecy surrounding these missions. Still, every now and then, even a few insiders fretted. Were these missions too provocative, too dangerous? Could one failed mission or one terrible accident coax the two superpowers to the brink? Could these spy missions inadvertently spark the very war they were designed to prevent? As long as these submarine operations remained secret, the Navy was rarely faced with these questions. It was only through 6 years of interviews that we were able to piece together events so long hidden, and then only with great effort and persistence. We contacted hundreds of submariners. Some responded by telephoning the Navy's investigators, and some simply declined to talk. Many others, however, agreed to meet in interviews that took place face-to-face throughout the United States. At times, the Naval Investigative Service visited or called these men, intoning grim reminders of secrecy oaths and legal obligations. But the details mounted nonetheless, as submarine officers, enlisted men, political figures, and intelligence officials decided the time had come to tell their stories. For the submariners especially, talking offered release. Most had never given the details of their months-long absences to their parents, wives, children, or best friends. They could never come home and just unload after hard months at work. They needed to speak to someone who understood, to find some long overdue recognition. And so we write about them, and for them. The people, their names, and the events in this book are real, and the tales told in each chapter are rendered as faithfully and scrupulously as possible, based on extensive interviews and the few documents that have been released. Conversations are related here, as they were repeated to us by people who were involved or who were there to hear the words as they were spoken. Still, not all of the people we describe in this book talk to us. Instead, they are here because they were at the heart of some of the most critical operations of the Cold War. In most cases, we had to promise our sources that they would be protected, that we would not attribute information to them or disclose even that we had met with them. Most of the stories in Blind Man's Bluff have never been told publicly, and none have ever been told in this level of detail. So instead of repeatedly pointing out each time we offer new information, we have decided to flag, either in the text or in footnotes, only the details that were already available. The rest of this book is a first, even for many of the men who served full careers in the submarine service, but were given only the information that the Navy deemed they had a need to know. This is a book about submarines, espionage, and geopolitics, but it is also a book about people. The poetry-spouting deep-sea scientist who was asked to conjure up ways of recovering nuclear missiles from the ocean floor. The naval intelligence officer whose childhood memories led him to conjure up the idea of tapping Soviet underwater communications cables. A cowboy sub-commander who couldn't resist sneaking up to within feet of Soviet subs. The men whose sub was held underwater with barely enough air to keep them alive as Soviet ships above rained down explosives. We also present new information that may solve the mystery of what happened to the USS Scorpion, an American spy sub that sank, all hands lost, 30 years ago. Most books about submarines focus on one man, perhaps the single most influential officer in the modern Navy, and the father of the nuclear submarine, Admiral Hyman G. Rickover. But even Rickover had to look on as other men drove his boats and led these missions. So this is not the story of one man, but the story of a force of men who served over decades. We trace their efforts through the decades in three phases, from the early fumblings through the greatest sea hunts to the times when technology and imagination allowed the sub force to reach straight into the Soviets' minds. And like so many great epics, this one does not end. American submariners are still being sent to keep an eye on Russia, as well as to peer at other hot spots around the globe. The stories here are not just a look in microcosm at the nation's mammoth espionage efforts. They are a lesson in how far governments will go to learn one another's secrets. no matter where they stand in time or place. Chapter 1. A Deadly Beginning. "You gotta be nuts," Harris M. Austin grumbled under his breath as he watched the ugliest-looking piece of junk he had ever seen pull into the British naval base in Londonderry, Northern Ireland. This couldn't be his sub. This couldn't be the Cochino. Almost anyone else on the busy pier would have thought that he was just a 28-year-old radio man. He knew better. He was here on direct orders from the U.S. Chief of Naval Operations. He had been briefed by admirals who commanded the U.S. naval forces in Europe, his background checked and double-checked. And today he was about to join the crew of this sub as one of the Navy's newest spies, a spook, someone who had been trained to snatch Soviet military signals and electronic communications out of thin air. It was going to be his job to attempt a daring grab for some of the Soviet Union's deepest secrets. Austin jumped down onto the pier and began pulling mooring lines along with a handful of other men. Then somebody said it, said that this was Cochino, U.S. submarine SS-345, the boat Austin had been awaiting for 3 days. "Goddamn ugly piece of junk," he thought, as he hoisted a sea bag stuffed with classified documents over his shoulder and lumbered down the hatch to introduce himself and his orders to Cochino's commanding officer, Commander Rafael C. Benitez. Austin had leapt to submarines from battle cruisers in a search for excitement, the same reason he had volunteered to make this latest leap, transforming himself from a radio man into a spook. That he was in the armed forces at all had been a near certainty from the day he was born. He came from a long line of Scottish warriors, a line he could trace back to the 14th century without breaking a sweat. His father had been a cook with an American air squadron in England before shifting to whalers and ocean freighters stateside. His Welsh mother had worked for a British ammunition company. Austin himself had been only 19 years old when he first went to sea, his auburn hair quickly earning him the nickname Red. Benitez, 32 years old, was one of those men who had been bred to decorum. His father was a judge in Puerto Rico, and Commander Benitez had just finished law school, a perk that the Navy had awarded to hold on to him. As a submarine officer during World War II, he had survived several depth chargings and earned a reputation for calm under fire. Now, in late July 1949, he had been back in the sub force for only 3 weeks, and he had his own command. Actually, it was a command Benitez had tried to turn down, embarrassed by his sub's name. Cochino may have been named for an Atlantic triggerfish, but in Spanish, the language of his family and friends back home, he would be commanding the submarine Pig. He had admitted as much to his mother when he wrote home, but her reply had yet to reach him as he stood in his cramped wardroom, shoulders back to make the most of his less-than-imposing frame. He was alone with this hulking enlisted man, this sailor-turned-spy, the kind of man who would still be declaring that he was tougher than shit when he reached his 70s. Red Austin handed over his orders. The captain scanned them and tensed as he read that Cochino, his sub, was about to become an experimental spy boat. Benitez was stunned. Cochino's mission was already complex enough. She had been scheduled to embark on a training run designed to change the very nature of submarine warfare. Classic World War II fleet submarines could dive beneath the waves only long enough to attack surface ships and avoid counterattack before needing to surface themselves. But since the war ended, Cochino and a few other boats had been dramatically altered. They now sported new, largely untested equipment, including a snorkel pipe that was supposed to let them take in fresh air, run the diesel engines, and shoot out engine exhaust without having to surface. That would allow the boats to spend much of their time underwater, rendering them effectively invisible, and making it possible for them to go after other subs as well as surface ships. Benitez had been expecting to take his submarine out and test her new equipment, train his crew, and learn how to run her as a true underwater vehicle. But Austin's orders were adding another dimension to Benitez's mission, transforming it from one of just war games and sea trials into an operation in an unproven realm of submarine intelligence. Furthermore, all this was to take place in the frigid Barents Sea, inside the Arctic Circle, near the waters around Murmansk, where the Soviet Union kept its northern fleet. The cables and antennas for Austin's crude eavesdropping gear had to pass directly through the sub's pressure hull. That meant drilling holes in the very steel that held the ocean back. Benitez took one look at the plans to drill through the sub's hull, what he considered the sub's last resort protective shell, and became clearly upset. What happened next is a story that Austin would tell and retell. "Drill holes in the pressure hull?" Benitez said loud enough to get the attention of his executive officer and chief of the boat, who came running. Drill holes without direct orders from the Navy's Bureau of Ships, which was supposed to oversee all submarine construction and modifications? "You got anything from Bew Ships?" he demanded. "No, sir, this is what they gave me," Austin replied. In a hapless gesture at conciliation, he added, "They're going to be small holes." Austin waited for a reply. There was none. Instead, Benitez turned and left the room. He was going to call London. He was going to take this to his command. At the very least, he was not going to stay and argue with Austin. There was already little room for error in these fragile and cramped diesel boats, where fuel oil permeated the air and electrical generators had a disturbing tendency to arc. There had always been countless possibilities for disaster. Sometimes mere survival took heroic effort. That was especially true during World War II, but at least then Benitez and the others had faced a known enemy in the more familiar waters of the Pacific. Now he might have to face violent storms at the outer edge of nowhere. And on top of all that, he was being asked to make a direct, from-the-sea grab for Soviet secrets, risk his boat and 78 men on a spy mission before anyone was certain the sub could survive the ocean itself. Benitez was back quickly, not quite contrite, but admittedly stuck. The orders had withstood his aristocratic ire. His first priority was now Austin's spy mission. It was with this rocky start that submariners and spies began forging a relationship that would come to define the Cold War under the world's oceans and seas. And from their battles would come new missions that would ultimately make these stealthy crafts the most crucial and ritually symbolic of the era. Already it was clear that the United States had a dangerous new adversary, and that the world was very different from the one that existed when Benitez had last emerged from the sea. Then, a nation inflated with victory had been transfixed by the image of a sailor grabbing a girl for an exuberant kiss in the middle of Times Square. Now, as Benitez prepared to return to the depths, people across the United States were terrified of the means of that victory. They had sat in stunned silence, in theaters, watching newsreels of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, crying at the sight of women and children horribly burned, women and children who once were only the enemy, faceless monsters who deserved nobody's tears. People who once cheered the bomb saw it as a looming horror that could, any day now, be aimed at their homes. There were reports that the Soviet Union, the ally turned enemy, was racing to build its own atomic bomb, and there seemed no doubt that the Soviets were out to make a grab for world dominance. The Chinese communists had just driven Chiang Kai-shek from China. A communist takeover had occurred in Czechoslovakia. The Soviets had instituted the Berlin blockade, and Winston Churchill had declared that an iron curtain had fallen over Eastern Europe. It seemed at any moment there could be a communist takeover within the United States. How else could the nation read the headlines pouring out of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, especially the sensational charges that a former State Department official, Alger Hiss, had spied for the Soviets? This was the atmosphere of mistrust that gave birth to the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, and plunged its agents into an immediate duel with Soviet spies. This was the era of fear that inspired the West to once again join forces, now as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. And all of this was the inspiration for the Blind Man's Challenge, the call for submariners in windowless cylinders to dive deep into a new role that would help the nation fend off this menace. The Soviets had always used their subs, most of them small and antiquated, for coastal defense. But in dividing up Nazi war booty, the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union had each come into a few experimental German U-boats, highly advanced subs with snorkels and new sophisticated types of sonar. This technology promised to make submarines more lethal than ever, and raised fears that the Soviets would change their coastal strategy and design subs for the high seas. What Benitez and the other commanders wanted most was time to learn, time to practice, time to transform their submarines into the hunter-killers needed to meet the flood of Soviet subs that might one day head for U.S. shores. Patterned after the Nazi technology, Cochino's snorkel promised to enable her to stay underwater for days or weeks, hiding tons of bulk that stretched as long as a football field, while showing only a target about as wide as a suburban garbage can. She could even stay hidden while she ran her diesel engines to recharge her batteries, her sole source of power when she needed to run silent with her engines off. Thanks to the Germans, Cochino had batteries with greater capacity than any of the classic World War II fleet subs. Cochino was also outfitted with a new passive sonar system. She could listen, and therefore see, underwater, without making much sound herself. World War II submarines used mainly active sonar, which sent out audible pings and relied on the echoing sound waves to create a picture of the surrounding waters by detecting targets and measuring distances. The result was a lot like shining a flashlight. Submarines could see what was out there, but they lit themselves up in the process. Passive sonar systems scanned the entire spectrum of sound, never sending out telltale tones, and this silent sight promised to provide the crucial edge in any undersea dogfight. The U.S. Navy was also preparing for the ultimate in undersea one-upmanship. An obscure engineer, Hyman G. Rickover, was developing a plan for nuclear-powered submarines that would be able to stay underwater indefinitely, without ever having to snorkel, raising the stakes in the undersea war once again. But for now, nuclear propulsion was little more than a concept, and Cochino and subs like her were the best the Navy had. In a new program, aptly named Operation KO, the Navy was readying Cochino and other World War II fleet boats to deliver a knockout punch, should war come. There was one hitch in the submarine forces' plans. The nation's spies saw more immediate threats and wanted to use subs to counter them. There was still no evidence that the Soviet Navy was building snorkel subs, and the CIA and the Office of Naval Intelligence thought the submariners had plenty of time to prepare for undersea dogfights that were still far in the future. More worrisome, in the opinion of senior intelligence officers, were other bits of inherited German technology. The unpiloted V-1 Buzz Bomb, a mini airplane on autopilot with a bomb on board, and the V-2, the first rocket to pass the speed of sound. These German designs, also seized by the Allies, were the forerunners to the cruise missile and the ballistic missile, bombs with their own rocket engines to propel them. The United States was already fashioning experimental Loon missiles that could be fired from specially configured boats, the first crewed missile subs. The Soviets were also showing signs that they were developing their own infant missiles. Reports were already coming in from defectors that the Soviets were conducting test launches from land and from old submarines stationed in the Murmansk area. In addition, the Air Force was sending planes armed with filters designed to capture radioactive particles near Soviet territory to gauge whether the Soviets were testing atomic weapons. That was the ultimate fear, that the buzz bombs would be given nuclear warheads, that they would lead to atomic missiles. Much of this was still conjecture. What little information the intelligence agencies had about the Soviet Navy was coming from Britain's Royal Navy, which had worked closely with the Soviets during World War II. Communications between Soviet ships and their bases were also being intercepted by U.S.-operated eavesdropping stations in Europe and Alaska. All of this spying on a former ally was so sensitive that messengers carried reports on the intercepted Soviet communications to top admirals in locked briefcases. Any efforts to get closer, to learn more, needed to be kept a deep secret. It was that need for stealth that, more than anything, convinced intelligence officials that submarines could be the next logical step in the creation of an eavesdropping network that would circle the Soviet Union. The effort was already underway. In 1948, the Navy had sent two fleet boats, the USS Sea Dog, SS-401, and the USS Blackfin, SS-322, into the Bering Sea to see whether they could intercept Soviet radio communications and count how quickly propeller blades turned on Soviet destroyers and merchant ships, a first step toward learning to identify them through passive sonar. But intelligence officials suspected that the new snorkel subs, like Cochino, could do even more. They could stay hidden off the Soviet coast and watch and monitor. Perhaps they could even find out firsthand how far along the Soviets were in developing the dangerous missile technology. With her snorkel, Cochino could sneak in as close as she dared. Only her periscope, antennas, and snorkel would ever have to broach into the open air. She was, in short, the perfect spy vehicle. In fact, Cochino had been destined from the start for a different fight. She had been the last submarine commissioned during the war, sent to sea 2 weeks after the Enola Gay dropped the first atomic bomb. Now she and the USS Tusk, SS-426, had been remade with these snorkels and other advances and turned into what the Navy called GUPPIES, an acronym that stood for Greater Underwater Propulsion Power. The acronym fit far better than anyone would have liked. As hunter-killers, these subs were rank beginners, learning to swim all over again. In fact, When scientists checked the boats a few months before this trip, they had discovered that their crews and construction personnel knew so little about the passive sonar systems that crucial hydrophones had not even been hooked up. So the boats had been sent to Londonderry to practice with the British, who had gotten much further in mastering the new sonar. It was in Londonderry that Austin caught up with Cochino. Also on board was a civilian sonar expert, Robert W. Philo, who was working as a consultant. The hunter-killer exercises were considered so important that the leader of Operation KO, Roy S. Benson, had come along and would end up on Tusk, commanded by Robert K. Worthington. Like Benitez, Worthington had taken command just days before they were all to leave for this trip, and like Benitez, Worthington and Benson were skeptical of their new trek into espionage. Benson believed that at best it was a side mission, one that wasn't nearly as important as training in the art of true underwater warfare. Red Austin thought he knew better, but then again, this spy stuff seemed to be his calling. "I got to have something spooky to do," Austin liked to say. "It's just the way I am." But if all of this was second nature to Austin, it wasn't to others. His special equipment was to be installed in a shipyard in Portsmouth, England, where even the yard workers were somewhat befuddled by the new gear. "Shit, this is just a piece of spaghetti," an impatient Austin fumed, holding onto a piece of coaxial cable that the workers just couldn't seem to install correctly. "Plain old coax, half inch, and it looks to me like you ought to be able to get plans to do this thing. Why can't you just go by the plans?" Austin was itching to get started. A tiny cubicle was being set up for him and his spy gear on the same deck as the control room, close to the radio room. He was ready to run the coaxial cable into what he called his black box. Actually, colored good old navy gray, the box was one of a kind, built to capture the radio signals that the Soviets would have to use to send telemetry instructions to any missiles they were trying to test. Standing but 2.5 feet tall, the box was designed to record signals on slivers of wire tape, and it was probably the most sensitive and secret device on Cochino. The line from that box would run up through the hull and connect to new ears placed on the side of the sub's sail, the large steel piece that created the shark fin on the submarine's otherwise smooth hull. These special antennas really did look like ears. They were little wire C's sprouting about a foot from the sail, one on each side. With these extra wires added to Cochino's array of the usual antennas, the sub had the look of a B-movie alien creature. Everything was finally installed by mid-August, and Cochino set out from Portsmouth, accompanied by Tusk and two standard fleet boats, the USS Toro, SS-422, and the USS Corsair, SS-435. They were operating under strict radio silence on what the Navy called a simulated war patrol. No one on shore was supposed to know where they were. When they left England, they were to disappear. Within hours of their departure, the seals around Austin's cables gave way, giving Austin an unwelcome shower inside his cubicle. He managed, with a bit of tightening and some fiddling, to get his system working again. But if the seals failed again, he would have to clamp off his cables, and his part of the mission would be over. By now, the crew knew that this mission was going to be different, just as most knew that their newest crew member was not what he seemed. Red Austin might have worn a radio man's sparks on his uniform, but he really worked for the Naval Security Group, the fabled cryptological service that had intercepted and decoded crucial Japanese Navy communications during World War II. That much was secret, but even the crew realized that no common radio man would ever consult this closely with the captain. Still, submariners are submariners, and the most popular on board are always going to be the guys with the best sea stories. That was especially true on Cochino, where about one-third of the crew had been through the war. Austin brought war stories from his cruiser days, and he played a mean game of acey-deucey, a sailor's take on backgammon that had been carried to sea for more than a century. Besides, it was hard not to become fast friends when everyone was hot-bunking, grabbing sleep when other guys woke up, moving on to make space for the next shift, timeshare, submarine style. The crew was divided into three groups, operating according to three different time zones. One group lived by Eastern Standard Time, another by Honolulu Time, and another by Indian Ocean Time. There were three sets of sonar operators, of weapons techs, of cooks, of radio operators, of men for whatever job needed to be done. Only the CO, his executive officer, XO, Lieutenant Commander Richard M. Wright, Austin, and his assistant lived across those time zones. Austin didn't mind his triple duty load, not when he got a chance to eat some of the three breakfasts, three lunches, and three dinners served on board every day. The man loved food, even spam, and he saw no reason to quarrel with powdered eggs. It was after one of Austin's first or second lunches or dinners that Benitez grabbed him for duty in the conning tower, a cramped space a ladder's distance above the sub's control room, the place from which the commander or other officer in charge directed the sub. "Man the number two periscope, Austin," the captain directed. It was a post where he could keep Austin busy and involved. It was also, Austin was certain, a post from which Benitez knew he could keep a wary eye on him. Soon the two fleet boats that had accompanied Cochino and Tusk broke off and headed toward the edge of the Arctic ice pack northeast of Greenland for exercises in those frigid waters. Cochino and Tusk continued on, heading much closer to the Soviet Union. They spent their first few hours chugging up through the Norwegian Sea north of the Arctic Circle. Both subs had faucet-like spigots in their torpedo rooms to take in water for temperature and salinity tests, and both were charting the sea bottom. By Saturday, August 20th, 1949, the boats were in the Barents. Now they too split up, Tusk to go off and conduct sonar tests, and Cochino to head toward a spot about 12 miles off the northern tip of Norway to begin Austin's mission. From here on out, Benitez would order the course changes requested by Austin, zigging the sub this way and zagging that way as the spook tried to hone in on Soviet signals. Austin tried not to let on, but he was worried. If he was to capture any signals, those special ear-shaped antennas would have to be raised above the waves. That meant that the sub would have to plane up, travel shallower than even snorkel depth, and expose part of her sail. This time of year, this far north, the sky was bright even at night, and the crew would have to be careful to avoid detection by the surface ships and fishing trawlers that dotted these waters. The long day also increased the danger of being spotted if Cochino had to surface. "Too much daylight," Austin fretted. "This bodes evil. No place to hide." Benitez was logging similar concerns. "The night, as such, has disappeared," he wrote. "The best we can hope for is about 2 hours of semi-darkness. There can be no surface running here during wartime." Austin swept for electronic signals as Cochino passed by the northeastern edge of Norway. Now the sub was about 125 to 150 miles away from Murmansk, too far away to see land, but close enough, he hoped, to intercept Soviet missile telemetry. This was about as close as Benitez wanted to go. On a map, Murmansk sits on what looks like the base of the thumb of a landmass shaped like an inverted glove, its fingers defined by Norway, Sweden, and Finland. The thumb is the Soviet Kola Peninsula, home to the operating bases of Vayenga, later called Sievierimirsk, and Polyarny. These were among the Soviets' most important northern ports because they could be used year-round, kept warm enough to be free of ice by a branch of the Gulf Stream. Polyarny was a submarine base, as well as home to the subterranean headquarters for the commander-in-chief of the Northern Fleet. Secreted beneath brick and stone administrative buildings were the Soviet code rooms and communication centers. Austin was looking for telemetry signals coming from these bases or from ships nearby. Because missile telemetries were usually broadcast in the highest ranges, intelligence officials had set Austin's black box to capture the higher frequency bands of a launch in progress. If something were happening, he should be able to hear it. Or so he hoped. This spy mission was as much a guessing game as anything else. There was no way to know whether the Soviets had planned any launches at all. All Austin could do was spin the dials in his cubicle and listen for any activity. He had also taken to wandering into the radio room and tuning into Russian voice communications. Austin didn't speak Russian, and neither did the radio men. But Austin could pick out the Cyrillic alphabet in Morse code, one of those tricks he had learned to fill the tedium during his days on surface ships. Now, as he sat clacking out Russian on Cochino's manual typewriter, he imagined he could actually understand what he was typing. In his mind, one Soviet ship was making a daily report, telling its command how much rice was on board, that the fruit had all been eaten. Another was reporting the day's sick list. 3 days passed, and Austin had still collected only a few Soviet voice transmissions. Benitez decided to make one more nighttime pass to give Austin a chance to find more. Austin would have been willing to sit for weeks. He was itching to nab the Grail, to record some Soviet missile telemetry. It was on this last evening that something began to come through. It didn't sound like a launch, but Austin had also been told to look out for equipment tests. Maybe that's what was going on. Maybe the Russians were tuning up their gear, getting ready for a show. He asked Benitez to order a turn to try to position Cochino for a clearer signal. Even after that, Austin was still not sure what he was hearing, or even whether it was coming from land or from sea. This wasn't voice, that much he knew. For a moment the frequency seemed about right for a weapons test, but there wasn't nearly enough coming through. In fact, not anywhere near the wash of sound that would have signaled the telemetry from a missile test. Intelligence officials back home might have imagined that the Soviets were engaged in endless launchings, readying to take their missiles to sea. But if that were the case, the Soviets had taken a break just as Cochino came near. Austin's spy mission was a failure, at least so far. He was scheduled to get another try later, but for now Cochino was going back to her initial mission. She was going to play hide-and-seek with Tusk, so the two subs could learn, like any young predators, how to become hunters and killers. By now, even Benitez was disappointed as he turned Cochino from the area. For all of the trouble Austin's orders had caused, the commander would have liked to have been able to go back and say, "Ah, we got something," to log in his patrol report that, "We intercepted this or we intercepted that." Still, as he began ordering course, west and north, he was glad to be getting on to what he considered his primary mission. In fact, he was feeling quite light-hearted. It was Wednesday, August 24th, a day before Cochino's fourth birthday, and Benitez had called for an early celebration. The cooks were at work, preparing a large birthday cake and a steak dinner that even Austin had to agree was better than Spam. There were songs, jokes, and pre-recorded birthday wishes set down that morning by some of the men eating in the mess. Later, Benitez would log, "It was a happy ship, and in the wardroom we expressed the wish that the next birthday would find us all together on board Cochino." Early the next morning, Cochino spotted Tusk off her starboard beam. By 10:30 a.m. that Thursday, Cochino began moving ahead at snorkel depth. It was her turn to hide. Tusk had already moved away to perform the submarine version of counting to 10. It was a gloomy day, misty and gray, with rough seas. The radio room had earlier picked up a forecast of polar storms, and the winds had been blowing for hours. The waves rocked Cochino, and the plainsmen struggled to maintain steady depth as the crewmen braced themselves, grabbing chart tables and overhead pipes. Others lunged to catch sliding coffee cups and tools. The forward engine room got on the squawk box and told Benitez that water was pouring into the sub through the snorkel, which should have been automatically capped watertight by a valve designed to slam shut as soon as its sensors got wet. Benitez sent Wright, his XO, back to investigate as the engines cut off for lack of air. Just about 2 minutes later, there was a muffled thud, and the sub shuddered. Austin slammed hard against the viewer on the number two periscope. He was certain they had bumped a deadhead, a log, and just as certain that he'd have two black eyes to prove it. But what was actually happening was far worse. An electrician saw sparks coming from one of the two compartments that each held two of the massive batteries that powered Cochino when she was underwater. The compartments were located toward the middle of the submarine. The batteries in one of the spaces, the after battery compartment, were on fire, and smoke was filling the room. "Clear the compartment!" the electrician shouted, staying behind to try to find a way to put out the fire. Men began moving forward to the control room, bringing the news to Benitez.
"Fire in the after battery!"
someone gasped. Benitez answered with an order.
"Surface!"
Then he turned to one of the new devices they were testing, an underwater phone, and sent a message to Tusk. "Casualty. Surfacing." The men blew ballast, and Cochino broke the surface within moments, rocking fiercely in the stormy seas, 16-foot waves crashing against her hull. The captain headed back to the conning tower. Then he opened the hatch and climbed out onto the weather bridge, a large protrusion off the sub's notched steel sail. From here he was well above the main deck, trying to scan for Tusk, his binoculars all but useless. Calling down the ladder to the control room, Benitez sent one of the sub's youngest officers, Ensign John P. Shelton, back to report on the fire. Other men ran to try to help fight the flames, but there was a terrible delay. The emergency breathing apparatus that should have protected the lead man from the smoke and gases wouldn't work. By the time he could send for another, the watertight door leading to the room was jammed, perhaps held by the pressures building from within, or melted shut by the heat of the fire. Inside, one battery seemed to be charging another, emitting highly combustible hydrogen gas as a byproduct. Unless someone could break into the fiery compartment, unless someone could push a wrench against heavy switches to break the connections between the burning batteries, the hydrogen would build to critical levels, and there would be another explosion. With a large enough blast, Cochino could be lost. Benitez left the bridge and headed to the control room. There he checked the hydrogen detectors. They still read zero. For a moment he was thankful, but just for a moment. Then he realized the detectors simply weren't working. He knew there was only one option. Somebody was going to have to force their way into the battery compartment from the other side, from the forward engine room. Somebody had to try again to get in, to disconnect the batteries. Just then, Wright phoned forward. He was going to try to do just that. He outlined his plan tersely and without any unnecessary rendition of the risks. Both he and Benitez knew that the battery space could explode at any moment, that any attempt to enter might prove fatal. They also knew that Wright had to try. Worried, Benitez climbed back to the bridge to look for the only help nearby, the men on Tusk. He was there when he felt the second explosion, a blast that ripped off a flapper that had isolated smoke from the burning compartment from the rest of the ventilation system. Smoke and toxic gases were now pouring through to the forward part of the sub. Someone called up to the bridge. The men below were in serious trouble. Benitez ordered an evacuation, calling topside anyone who wasn't manning a critical position or fighting the fire. The men began moving forward, any instinct to panic overwhelmed by the almost unbelievable magnitude of the casualty. One after another, some gasping for air, they made their way to the bow, the very front of the sub, and climbed up the ladder leading to a topside hatch. Under captain's orders, they headed to the handrail at the lee side of the sail and lashed themselves to it. It was bitter cold, and waves were still slamming down on the rolling boat. Some of the men had come straight out of the sack, wearing only socks, t-shirts, and skivvies. A couple were wrapped in blankets. Only a few wore foul-weather jackets. Among them, they had only a few life jackets, and no food, no water, no medical supplies. They were, for the most part, defenseless against the cold and pounding seas. By now, there were 47 men lashed on deck. Another 12 had crowded onto the bridge alongside Benitez, though the space was designed to hold 7 men. There were still 18 men back aft, trying to regain propulsion and fight the fire. The captain looked down at his crew, then out at the horizon. Where was Tusk? The blaze had now been raging for half an hour. Someone managed to restart Cochino's engines. Benitez began to have hopes that he could drive the boat to shore when a wave came up and swallowed her stern. A cry emerged before the water receded.
"Man overboard! Man overboard!"
It was Joseph Morgan, one of Cochino's cooks.
"Gotta go pick him up,"
Benitez mumbled, now entirely focused on moving his sub closer to Morgan, who was barely visible in the turbulent seas. Just then someone spotted Tusk off the starboard quarter. Austin had, by now, made his way onto the bridge beside Benitez. All of Cochino's signal men had been gassed, and Austin was the only person left standing who knew enough code to transmit a message. He hadn't used semaphores since boot camp, but now he grabbed hold of 2 flags and raised his hands high. Fighting the wind, he spelled out, "Man overboard. Dead ahead. Fire in the after battery." It was 11:21 a.m. Then there was a roar from within the sub that shuddered through her steel deck plating. Tusk was trying to move in closer, but Benitez kept his eyes on the drowning cook, aware that the man couldn't last much longer, not in waters this cold. Without prompting, Chief Hubert H. Rausch jumped in after Morgan and fought the choking seas to get to his side. By the time Rausch pulled Morgan alongside, the chief was too weakened by the 40-degree water to help lift Morgan onto the deck. Another of the ship's cooks unlashed his restraints and ran to help, leaning over the side of the ship to take Morgan from Rausch's arms. Others reached for Rausch, while Morgan was carried to the bridge and laid down on a small shelf that was designed as a chart table. He was shivering uncontrollably, even as the men covered him with the few blankets they had. Two men stripped off their sodden clothes and sandwiched the freezing Morgan, trying desperately to warm him. It was clear to Benitez that his men weren't safe out in the open, not with the seas breaking violently over the deck, ready to tear his freezing crew from their lashings. He ordered his men to crowd onto the narrow bridge. They stacked themselves, creating a human pyramid. He told others to move down into the forward torpedo room at the bow, just about the only area still somewhat habitable. As all of this was going on, Benitez learned that the same explosion that had sent smoke and gases pouring through the sub had also left serious casualties. Wright had managed to force open the door to the battery compartment, but when he did, built-up hydrogen gas exploded in a massive flash, throwing him backward. He had been badly burned over his hands, chest, legs, the entire front of his body, save for his face, which was protected by his breathing mask. Now he was in severe shock. Four other men had also been seriously injured. The wounded had been dragged to the after torpedo room, the compartment farthest astern. They were separated from their mates by the fire. They needed medical help desperately, but the medic, Hubert T. Doc Eason, was up front with the rest of the crew. There was no way to get through the fire and gas from inside the sub. Doc could climb outside and go over the fire, but the hatch to the after torpedo room was more than 50 yards away. 50 yards of slippery, wet steel on a sub bouncing through crashing waves that were so powerful they were pushing Tusk around like a twig as she tried to move in to help. One young officer offered to race a line from the sail to the back hatch, a lifeline that Doc Eason could then hang on to. When the line was set, Eason crawled, fought the violent surf, and made his way back and down the hatch that led to the wounded. Austin picked up his flags and began to signal, "Come alongside. We may have to abandon ship." As soon as Benitez received Doc Eason's first reports, Austin picked up the flags again. "Require medical assistance. 5 men injured. 1 badly burned. The bridge had received Eason's diagnosis. Wright was critically burned and not expected to live. Doc's reports were so dire that Benitez soon took the sound-powered phone away from the enlisted man who had been relaying messages. The news was too bad to be broadcast to the enlisted.